I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama dabbed his eyes when he spoke about his wife at his farewell address last week.
Michelle LaVon Robinson, girl of the South Side. For the past 25 years, you have not only been my wife and mother of my children, you have been my best friend. You took on a role you didn't ask for, and you made it your own with grace and with grit and with style. You made the White House a place that belongs to everybody. And a new generation sets its sights higher because it has you as a role model. So you have made me proud, and you have made the country proud.
Michelle Obama called herself the mom-in-chief whose main job was raising their two daughters in the fishbowl of Washington, D.C. The last 8 years have been the first time the Obamas lived together as a family. Think about that. The First Lady became a style and fashion icon whose toned arms made headlines, and she chose to combat childhood obesity and speak out for veterans' families. She could dance, she could sing, as she did with Jimmy Fallon, Ellen DeGeneres, James Corden, among others. 8 years ago, Michelle Obama was not sure how she would use her position and power as First Lady and was skeptical about the political process. She leaves more popular than her husband. Joining us to talk about Michelle Obama is Veronica Chambers, editor of a new book called The Meaning of Michelle, 16 Writers on the Iconic First Lady. She's currently a JSK Fellow at Stanford University, joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Veronica Chambers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. And joining us by telephone is Jody Cantor. She's a New York Times correspondent, has been covering the Obamas since 2007, and her book, The Obamas, is out in paperback. And Jody Cantor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. I hope you don't hear the siren outside on 8th Avenue in New York City.
Well, we do, but that is okay. We will carry on. Let me start with a big question, and I'll put this to you, Veronica Chambers. Much has been made about President Obama's legacy. What do you think Michelle Obama's legacy will be?
I think there's a lot of things that we're going to point to, and I think in the long term, it'll take some time for us to really see the impact. But the two words that come to mind to me are possibility and authenticity. I think that she represents possibility to so many women and girls. And I think the authenticity is something that, as many writers have talked about, something that she worked at and honed and developed and really represents everything that she stepped into in the role.
And for you, Jody Cantor, what do you think?
So I want to name one thing that's obvious and one thing that's not obvious. So the obvious thing is that being the first African-American First Lady was just such an enormous contribution. And Mrs. Obama often did it in a way that represented opportunity for everybody. Her consistent message was, nothing in my life foretold that I would be First Lady. I come from a modest background. I'm a daughter of the South Side, as the president said. And yet I worked hard and I got an education and, and here I am. She even a few times said, I live in a house built by slaves, to talk about her family's remarkable journey. And when she did that, she would not only project a sense of opportunity in this country, but all over the world. She would kind of amplify that message. When she went to places like India, for example, she did an appearance there where she got together with orphans and street kids. She played hopscotch with them. She danced with them. And so she took, all over the world, people see the civil rights struggle as metaphorical, right, and have applied it to kind of their own situations. And she almost did that as First Lady and said, look, my life journey is a metaphor for what everybody can experience. The thing that is less obvious about her legacy, and this is really what my book, The Obamas, is about, is that I think we very much see the President Barack Obama, who Michelle Obama wanted us to see. And what I mean by that is that she has had a really important influence on his career and his time in the White House in the following way, not in sort of being deeply involved in day-to-day legislative details. She doesn't burst into the West Wing and say, write the rule this way instead of that way. But she, from very early on, had a vision of what kind of politician she wanted her husband to be. She actually hated politics. And she said, if you're going to be a politician, if my husband, who is so bright and, you know, was the president of the Harvard Law Review, and I see us having so much promise, and this is such a big sacrifice for us, that if you're going to do this, I want you to be a different kind of politician. I want you to be above it all. I want you to be inspiring. I want you to create real change. And that not only helped him propel himself to the White House, but it was very important in the White House, because the president had times when political advisors were pressuring him to do kind of the more expedient thing. But Michelle Obama wanted her husband to get big things done in office, to set a different kind of tone. So almost the way Jackie Kennedy ended up writing the sort of public story of the Kennedy administration after her husband's assassination, I think in a different way, Michelle Obama was able to kind of write the story of who her husband would be on the public stage.
Well, let me go back to you, Veronica, picking up on what Jody just said there. And one of the things I scribbled down is a question, would there be a President Obama without Michelle Obama? And now we cannot run that experiment.
Right.
But based on what Jody said, and even from what some of the people in your book said, can we imagine one without the other?
Well, I think that it's hard to imagine it. I think that their marriage, one of the things that they showed us was a very powerful marriage in public, and it meant a lot because we don't have a lot of examples of that as an African-American community and as a community at large that plays at that large level. One of my favorite essays in the book is by Alicia Hall Moran and Jason Moran. Alicia's joining us tonight at the Free Library. And they talk about creativity and partnership and power and how you take a step forward sometimes and your partner takes a step back. And I think that we saw that writ large, and it was very powerful, exactly as Jody described.
And Veronica, what's so interesting, and I said this in my introduction, and this is the first time that they lived together as a family, mother, father, children, and of course, mother-in-law as well, but lived together as a family in the White House of all places. I mean, talk about a fishbowl, right?
Right. Yes. But, you know, at the same time, there was this beautiful image that the Hamilton musical tweeted out, and they tweeted a lyric from Hamilton, and they said, "We'll come of age in this young nation." And you see the family in 2009, and you see them come of it 2016. And I think, you know, it was very powerful for them to be able to do that together there. The circumstances made it possible. I mean, that's what she said. This is the first time you can come home for dinner every night. And I think that that circumstances made it possible, but it also mirrored and modeled something powerful for Americans, and I think for African Americans particularly.
Jody, it's so interesting to go back 8 years ago, and it clearly she was reluctant. In fact, well, for a time, Michelle Obama was thinking that she would stay with the girls in Chicago, and maybe while they finished school, and her husband could, in a sense, get established as president of the United States. But she did come, and how much do you think her reluctance affected how she was as first lady?
So when I sat down to write my book, I had been reporting on the Obamas for a couple of years. And the reason I decided to write my book is that I saw a few after I started reporting in the White House and, you know, kind of followed them there. I guess what I really saw is that becoming president and first lady is not something that happens in 1 second on inauguration day when the president finishes taking the oath of office. It is a really deep and transformative process. And everybody who does it goes through this question of, you know, how am I going to grapple with and fulfill this role? And in my book, the White House is practically a character, because living there is so strange. We're used to having these very glamorous images of the White House. We, you know, see the pictures of state dinners. We go to D.C. and take White House tours. But it's really hard for a family. The White House is all at once a museum, a secure military installation. It's the president's office. It's the first family's residence. And all of those uses are kind of bumping up against each other all the time. And I think Michelle Obama was prescient.
I think
right?
It is. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Prescient. Okay. I think she was prescient when she saw the White House and saw what living there would look like. The Obamas very much wanted to preserve their lives in Chicago. And in my book, I tell the stories of how that ended up being impossible. They tried to go home for the weekend, and it was basically a disaster because it was so complicated. And in the White House, despite despite all of the glory and the history, there are some really tough things about living there. You can't even just go run into the backyard because there may be an event going on or a tour group coming through. At one point, there were bullets, maybe one stray bullet that struck the back of the White House. That was a really terrifying thing. That's where Malia and Sasha used to, you know, kick their soccer ball around. The family doesn't have a private entrance or exit, so, you know, there's no way of coming or going undetected. Another thing is that every member of a presidential family has a different layer of security. So what I often say to readers is, imagine your family and imagine the family life you have now, but, you know, Dad basically can't go anywhere without a huge fuss. He has a motorcade of about 21 cars if he wants to travel. Mom can move around in the world a little bit more easily, but she still has a lot of security, meaning her going places can inconvenience other people, it can attract attention, et cetera, et cetera. And then Sasha and Malia, let's say the kids, have a lot more freedom of movement. They have a tiny bit of security. And Grandma is the only member of the family who is totally free to come and go as she pleases. You know, what would your family life be like that? Also, remember that the Obamas were in the White House in the age of mobile phones, and that made a huge difference because anytime they were anywhere, people could photograph them, tweet about it, et cetera, et cetera. There's kind of a sad story I tell in the book about Malia and Sasha and the first Halloween they spent in the White House. They really wanted to trick-or-treat like normal kids, so some family friends took them out, and they found a neighborhood to go to. And in the first few minutes, it worked. And then they were outed, you know, and people started texting one another and taking videos. And it became a little bit of a scene. And they had to go back to the White House before they could finish trick-or-treating.
Yeah, hold on to that thought. Go ahead, Veronica.
Well, you know, to jump on the point of them being the first family of social media, I think one of the things that Michelle Obama got very savvy about was the fact that if all eyes are going to be on me, I'm going to pull other people into the picture. And I think that's one of the things that made her so beloved, that she brought in the elderly, she brought in children, she brought the Girl Scouts onto the White House lawn. It was almost like she was constantly inviting everyday Americans, that 106-year-old African-American lady dancing with her. It's like she was inviting them to be part of this. Okay, if it's going to be a show, it's not just going to be a show about me and my dresses. It's going to be a show about people that you've never seen before. And I think she did that so powerfully and beautifully.
And we're almost up in a break here. Veronica, you call her a homegirl.
Right? I do. Yes. I mean, I think that that's what the president said, a girl from the South Side. I think for those of us who grew up in those communities, she feels very familiar. And it's her birthday.
And it's her birthday. And that is Veronica Chambers, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, editor of The Meaning of Michelle. She's also a fellow at Stanford University. Jody Cantor joining us by telephone, New York Times correspondent, and wrote a book called The Obamas. And we are talking about Michelle Obama, the legacy of Michelle Obama. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with Jody Cantor and Veronica Chambers about Michelle Obama. And in a couple of days, she and her family will be moving out of the White House. We want to know what you think of the First Lady, 1-888-477-9499. I was thinking, as both of you were talking, but I'll put this to you, Veronica, about this, the sort of authenticity that I think any First Lady, including this one, has to sort of create, this public persona that they have to create out of who they are. And it's not to say that they're inauthentic, but that they can't necessarily show all parts of themselves in this very public role. How do you see that?
Well, I think that this is Veronica Chambers. And I think that one of the powerful things that Michelle Obama was able to do over the last 8 years is that she took this stereotype of the strong black woman or the angry black woman. And what she did was she said from early on, you don't even know me. And so what she did is she let us get to know her. And through things like the mom dancing with Jimmy Fallon, the stuff she did with Ellen DeGeneres, the college rap, I mean, again and again, she was sort of fearless about putting herself out there in a way that not only we hadn't seen a first lady, but that we didn't always see a black woman who wasn't an entertainer. And so she showed us, I think, and a lot of the people in the book say, a kind of the joy of our experience, a part of our experience as black women that you really rarely saw. And it was very freeing and it was very powerful.
And her humor?
I think her humor is a sign of her power. I mean, Marcus Samuelson talks about in the book that power whispers. And I think that one of the things that she's done is she's never had to say, I'm powerful. What she's done is she's done what she wanted. You know, that great quote that she says is, find your space, do what you love, wear what you like. And I think that's what she did, and that's what she modeled for women of all backgrounds.
Joe, do you want to weigh in on that as well? And again, you interviewed the Obamas. This was earlier on in their tenure in the White House. But it is an interesting and perhaps slightly anachronistic role to be the first lady. Even those words don't exactly fit the 21st century.
Well, I want to throw out a provocative thought I had. And by the way, Veronica, I really enjoyed your book. And as I was reading it, one of the things I was thinking about was, would this role have even worked if Mrs. Obama wasn't Mrs. Obama, wasn't an African-American woman from the South Side? And what I mean by that is that the first lady job is really a throwback. It is really outdated in many ways. The first spouse can't hold the job, has all of these ceremonial positions. On the one hand, the job comes with a lot of duty. On the other hand, it's an unelected position with kind of no real job description. And I think part of the reason it worked this time around was that it was so exciting to see an African-American woman in the role and an African-American woman who brought a lot of freshness and a real ability to communicate and kind of her own charisma and sense of how to connect with people to the role. You know, we see that with the Trump administration, there are a lot of questions about whether even Melania Trump wants to be a kind of typical first lady. She may delegate parts of the job to Ivanka Trump. And I'm not surprised by that because the role in today's society doesn't exactly
Strange.
Feel current. If Hillary Clinton had won, we would have had a first gentleman instead.
Which would have raised a whole bunch of other questions. Veronica, let me go back to you. And a number of people in your book talk about her body. And I have to say, we talked about her, we meaning the United States, we talked about how she looked. This happens, I think, with first ladies. There was her arms, her toned arms, the clothing that she wore, how she wore her hair. There was much both judgment and I think admiration for just the fashion, the style, the look of Michelle Obama.
Yes. And I think,
was that appropriate, you think? Did it matter?
I think whether or not it was appropriate, I think it's part of our times, you know, that whole ask her something else movement. The fact is we always ask women about what they wear. What was very powerful for me in putting together the book was that Sarah Lewis, the art historian from Harvard, talked about the role of representation and justice. And she's one of the things she said that was so powerful to me is that she said race turns looking into work. And she says that from the days of Frederick Douglass, he was calling for a kind of portraiture that would change the dialogue. And so I think one of the things that she was very savvy about is the images and how images change dialogue. And so I think that she changed not just standards of beauty, but really a whole idea of where we've seen black women, how we look at black women, and what we expect, and broaden that sense of it.
It's also, and perhaps this is true for other first ladies, is making a fashion statement becomes also making a political statement. I mean, the fact that she chose so many young and up-and-coming American fashion designers, for instance.
Absolutely, and that was a very deliberate choice. You know, there was a study at NYU Business School that her fashion choices were worth, over the course of 8 years, $2.7 billion on the fashion industry for the brands she wore consistently. You don't get that with a Jennifer Lawrence or a Rihanna or a Beyonce. People don't see her on TV and the dress sells out in minutes, as they did with some of the dresses she wore to the president's addresses.
Well, and I remember, Jody, early on her being asked, I forget who the TV host was, what she was wearing, and she said, J. Crew. But she obviously wore very, very fancy and high-priced clothing as well.
Well, so that was a point of tension inside the White House. This, I think, was one of the most fascinating debates I uncovered while writing my book. Remember that the president took office at a time of great economic suffering. And even when the economy got better, income inequality has been one of the defining forces of our time. So there was actually some concern among the president's advisors about the way that Mrs. Obama dressed, especially the fancier gowns for the state dinners, the more expensive stuff she wore. Their worry was that the Obamas in the 2008 campaign had done a great job of presenting themselves as real people and economically more rooted in everyday life than, say, the McCains, the Bushes, et cetera, et cetera. And they worried that by kind of wearing all these fancy designers, Mrs. Obama was surrendering what was really an asset and setting herself up for criticism. Now, Mrs. Obama did not agree with that. And part of it was because she was the first African-American first lady, felt really strongly about the power of image. For example, she wanted to be on the cover of Vogue when she was invited because there had been so few women of color on the cover of Vogue over the course of years. And I, you know, as a reporter, it's not that I think that there's a right or a wrong answer to that debate, but I think it makes us appreciate the complexity of what it meant to be the first African-American first lady.
Because people look at you, they judge you, they come away with a kind of impression. You want to add to that, Veronica?
And just to have to choose between those two messages, right? Do I want to send an economic message? Do I want to send this message of representation? Everything is so parsed. I'm sorry, go ahead, Veronica.
No, that's okay. No. Go ahead, Veronica.
I would also just say that I think that the whole question of dressing up for African-American women has always been powerful because we've always dressed well as a sign of both putting our best self forward, showing respect for a position. You know, I think that you see it. There's a term called Harlem proper. And since the days of the Harlem Renaissance, Black women have dressed as well as we've been able to. So I think that if somehow in an attempt to sort of be part of the times, she hadn't like embraced the opportunity to dress as well as she was able, that would have seemed actually inauthentic or out of character.
That's so interesting because she's been compared to Jackie Onassis, but you're saying it meant something different because she was African-American woman.
I think so. I mean, I think you see it in the Harlem proper, the Sunday dressing. You know, you go to any kind of Black church on a Sunday, you know, there was a famous saying in the Harlem Renaissance that, like, you know, I'd rather be a lamppost in Harlem than governor of Georgia. And the fact is, you see women dress up. And we dress up partly just to show a love of life, to show a love of fashion. We've been part of the fashion industry for a long time, although we haven't always been the designers. We've been the seamstresses. A Black woman made Jackie Kennedy's wedding dress. So, you know, I think that she was very savvy in that her choices spoke to both our community and the community at large.
I do want to play a clip from the Democratic National Convention, but let me just first reintroduce the two of you. That's Veronica Chambers, editor of The Meaning of Michelle, 16 writers on the iconic First Lady. Jody Kantor, New York Times correspondent, author of a book that's now on paperback called The Obamas. And we are talking about Michelle Obama, what she brought to the White House, her legacy. Probably too early to get that all nailed down, but nonetheless, something to think about. Let me play a clip from the Democratic National Convention here in Philadelphia. And again, this is part of her speech where she does reference, although we don't include it, the fact that the White House was built by slaves, but she does talk about being a mom, and then she levels some criticism. Let's give it a listen.
I also told you about our daughters, how they are the heart of our hearts, the center of our world, and during our time in the White House, we've had the joy of watching them grow from bubbly little girls into poised young women, a journey that started soon after we arrived in Washington, when they set off for their first day at their new school. I will never forget that winter morning as I watched our girls, just 7 and 10 years old, pile into those Black SUVs with all those big men with guns. and I saw their little faces pressed up against the window. And the only thing I could think was, what have we done? See, because at that moment, I realized that our time in the White House would form the foundation for who they would become. And how well we managed this experience could truly make or break them. That is what Barack and I think about every day as we try to guide and protect our girls through the challenges of this unusual life in the spotlight. How we urge them to ignore those who question their father's citizenship or faith. How we insist that the hateful language they hear from public figures on TV does not represent the true spirit of this country.
And I wanted to play that full clip because to you both, to you, Jody, and to you, Veronica, and to our listeners, I thought it was such a powerful and in many ways clever political statement. And she begins, Jody, by talking about being a mom and what have we done to our children. And then she pivots without naming names, but she levels criticism at Donald Trump. And I thought it was just an example of just her clever political skills, maybe after 8 years in the White House.
One of the really fascinating things about having covered Michelle Obama for nearly a decade now has been watching the change in growth in her political voice. When I first started covering Michelle Obama, when she was out on the campaign trail in 2007, she had the same charisma and ability to connect as she does right now. She was much I'm trying to find the right word because I don't want to use a judgmental word because I don't want to. I think a conventional political consultant would say that she was much less polished than she is now, but I don't want to use that word because I think there was something really great about how direct she was in those early days. She didn't have a speechwriter. She just said what was on her mind, and that was part of why people really responded to her. It was a great alternative to what you usually hear in political speeches. The clip you just played, I think, represents her taking a little bit of that old quality, right, of being the person who really says what she thinks, and then melding and polishing and buffing it to a high finish to, as you said, that incredibly sort of sophisticated message that on the one hand sounds very, very personal and, you know, very much a mom voice, and then on the other hand packs a wallop. There's kind of this paradox to being First Lady where the less explicitly partisan you sound, the more effective a political argument you can make.
Oh, that's interesting. Veronica, you want to add to that?
Sure. I think that one of the things to build on what Jody's saying is that she's taken this role of mom in chief, and what we saw her do over 8 years is really become a dragon slayer for women and girls. And she did that with Bring Back Our Girls. She did that with Let Girls Learn. And, you know, as someone who has a 9-year-old daughter who she has not known any other first lady besides this, I can tell you that for her and her friends, there's this feeling that the role is redefined, that this is a woman who would go out there and kick butt and take names if necessary, if it meant she couldn't go to school or she couldn't play a sport or she couldn't do anything she set her heart to. That's a very powerful thing for young women, and it's a very powerful thing for families all over.
And Veronica, how much do you think she had to be careful about not being called an angry black woman? She was called that.
I think she was called that a lot, and I think there are people who still see her that way. I think there. I think that stereotype has been with us for a long time, and you know, not to get too intrinsic into the politics of things, but I feel like one of the really unfortunate things is I think the people who have not been able to embrace her or the backlash against her really has to do with a lot of the unaddressed racism between women and the fact that there are women who just could not embrace and see a beautiful brown-skinned woman in that office, in that role. And I just, honestly, it breaks my heart that we're still here.
And you see this as in a sense, women pitted against women?
Well, I think that you see when I think about all the white women who voted the way they did in the last election, despite what happened. I mean, the day after the election, my daughter said to me, she goes, but how could someone who said things like that be allowed to have that job? And that's not, I'm not making a political statement. Like, it just didn't make sense to her. And so the sense that, you know, a respect for women is tantamount, if you believe that, then why did that not matter? You start to feel like it does come down to a really sad state about race and people's inability to see past certain things.
You know, Jody, I'm going back to this is a bunch of years back early on in the first campaign where she says, Michelle Obama says, you know, essentially for the first time, I'm paraphrasing here, you know, I'm proud of my country. She said that after her husband was obviously in a winning position and people pounced on her for that. Do you understand that, Jody?
Well, so let's talk in two categories, right? Let's talk about a political culture that is just an attack culture, right? And anything you say that has sort of one word off can be pounced on. Of course, there's been a strange twist to this now, which is that Donald Trump has said all sorts of very atypical, surprising things. And he doesn't seem to have the usual politician's problem of, you know, having one word out of place and being and sort of losing ground for it. But leaving him aside for a second, I think what happened with the, you know, first time in my life, proud of my country comments is that she was really, you know, she said that she was trying to say something else and that she didn't mean it to phrase it in that exact way. And she was really pounced on for it. But then I want to cut to just a few weeks ago, because when Veronica, you were just talking, I was thinking about how, you know, even when Michelle Obama is at the kind of height of her popularity, and even when she's really bathed in public adulation, she is still subject to these revolting attacks that I think are not part of the sort of usual American political discourse. They're worse, and they seem racist. A couple of weeks ago, Trump's New York campaign co-chairman, Carl Palladino, made comments about Michelle Obama that were just breathtaking in their ugliness. He compared her to a male gorilla. And, you know, and this was also in a stage where, you know, usually at the end of a presidency, there's often, you know, a very dignified kind of like moment of farewell for the president and first lady. That's the American tradition. You sort of graciously wave them off the stage. So here's this woman who you know, who is like sort of in her swan song as first lady.
You know, Jody, hold on to that thought only because, we're up on a break and I know that Veronica wants to weigh in on this as well. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen talking with Veronica Chambers about Michelle Obama. Her new book that she edited is called The Meaning of Michelle. And joining us by telephone, Jody Cantor, and she's the author of a book called The Obamas, out in paperback. And we want you to join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jody, sorry I had to interrupt you. We were up on a break. And I know, Veronica, did you want to add anything to what was being talked about before
the
break?
Well, I think it's really interesting what we're talking about. Jody, you can tell me if you feel differently. But what I thought was an interesting counter to the, you know, first time in my life, proud of my country comment, was when she talked in her exit interview about this is what it feels like not to have hope. If you notice, Donald Trump did not attack her. He actually said, people said, well, she's attacking you. And he said, I don't think that's what she means. And it's been kind of incredible to me that this person who goes after everyone has really left her alone. And I just think he hasn't made the kind of attacks against her that he would make given the comments she's made. And I think that somehow seems like a sign of respect.
Well, that's it. I mean, what do you think that says about her? What do you think that says about Donald Trump? Do you know?
Well, I think what I'm waiting to see actually is whether she goes after him, to be honest, because Michelle Obama, if, you know, as first lady, was very limited in what she could say. But the Michelle Obama that friends from Chicago remember is a Harvard-trained lawyer. She's great at making arguments. She is, you know, a very thoughtful social critic. She has her own analysis and ideas about the country. She's sitting on 8 years' worth of observations about the country made from, you know, the highest vantage point in the land that she basically hasn't shared. And we know that she's going to be living in Donald Trump's America, which is a place that we know she is really going to object to. And so the question I have is the extent to which she speaks out after the White House. And there are kind of two dueling impulses, because on the one hand, we know that she never really wanted a part of public life, and she's very happy, I think, to go back to being a little bit more out of the public spotlight. On the other hand, Democrats really want to hear from her. She's one of the only figures who's considered very unifying in a fracturing party. And there are going to be a lot of things she's probably going to object to over the next couple of years. And I'm very curious to see the extent to which she speaks out about them.
What do you think, Veronica?
I think her New Hampshire speech will stand as one of the most powerful speeches about the rights of women and girls and about the microaggressions. I think one of the things that we're at a moment where racism and sexism doesn't come with big signs and, you know, hoods as much as they did before, but there are these moments, these small microaggressions. And her New Hampshire speech, where she talked about the moments when you feel you walk into a room and a man says something inappropriate, or you're walking down the street and all of a sudden you feel fear and that boundary is crossed. I think she's actually begun to speak in very powerful ways, always on behalf of women and girls, and saying what's not acceptable, what doesn't feel right. You know, it's a very, very few women in this country can say this doesn't feel right, and people don't say, oh, you're a woman and you're emotional and too bad for you. And she has said this doesn't feel right, and it has resonance and it has gravitas. And I think that's something that she did as First Lady that we should give her a lot of credit for.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You have a flavor for what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times, talking about Michelle Obama, First Lady, until just a couple of days from now. Let me get Barbara from Delaware to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
I just want to make a comment about the statement that Mrs. Obama made when she said that she's so proud of this country. It took me back to the fact that I'm a 62-year-old black woman, and in my lifetime, I've seen segregation. And so I don't understand why people were so upset with her when she made that comment, when in our lifetime, I mean, just, you know, my lifetime, there was segregation. There was a colored side and a white side. So that's why I think she said that, or that's what I took out of that comment that she made. And I don't see why people are offended, because they forget that, you know, segregation was in this country. And there are a lot of people that are still alive that had experienced it.
I appreciate your call to Radio Times, Barbara, in my lifetime as well. Go ahead, Veronica. And I'm sure, Jody, you want to add to that as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that call. And one thing I would say we'll see in her legacy is that Michelle Obama was a bridge between the 20th century and the 21st century. She is a daughter of the civil rights era who became the first iconic first lady of the 21st century. And so she carries with that a lot of history. And I think that we'll see that the actions that she made, what the president talked about, her grace, her grit, her wisdom, her style, is really about how we bridge our past into the future.
Jody, you want to add to that?
Well, I think the caller's question is great, because we're also at a time when pretty much everybody has a critique of this country, right? I mean, I as a reporter, you know, as a citizen of the United States, I don't know anybody who thinks that, you know, everything is going just fine and dandy right now. So given that everybody else in the country is entitled to their critique of what's going on, why isn't Michelle Obama? And that's part of what I'm waiting to hear when she is out of office. Part of what I write about in my book is that Barack and Michelle Obama have had this debate throughout their marriage about politics and cynicism and, you know, hope. Basically, he has been the dreamer, the idealist who believes that politics can accomplish a lot. Michelle Obama was the skeptic who said, no, there are other avenues for change. Politics is corrupt. Good ideas go nowhere. And when he won the White House in 2008, it seemed like he had won that debate. But we don't really know. I talk about it some in my book. But at the end of the presidency, how do they really feel? They've seen a lot of cause for hope. They've seen a lot of inspiring things, and they've seen a lot of really depressing things as well.
Well, and I'm thinking about all the tragedies of the last 8 years, the school shootings, other kinds of shootings, and it's a long list there. And I guess, Veronica, for any first family, you have to look back and see probably a mixed bag of success and lack of success?
I think one of the questions that we find ourselves asking as, you know, people of color, as minority communities, is how free are we? I think the fact that we could have, at the time of the first black president, the first African-American family in the White House, these massive shootings, the Black Lives Matter, the shootings in a church. I never thought that as someone who was born after the civil rights movement, that I would see people slain in a house of worship in the way that they were in Charlotte. And so I think the question of freedom, I actually think that she has consistently like put out a picture of hope and said that we got to keep going on. What the message, the sort of litany of survival is, we keep going no matter what happens, be it slavery, be it Jim Crow, be it, you know, police brutality. We just keep going and we keep reaching for better. That is what we have to do. And I think that's what we have to do as all Americans. And we need it more now than ever.
Well, let me play a clip from Michelle Obama's farewell speech when she spoke about hope.
It is our fundamental belief in the power of hope that has allowed us to rise above the voices of doubt and division, of anger and fear that we have faced in our own lives and in the life of this country. Our hope that if we work hard enough and believe in ourselves, then we can be whatever we dream, regardless of the limitations that others may place on us. The hope that when people see us for who we truly are, maybe, just maybe, they too will be inspired to rise to their best possible selves.
It's interesting, Jody, as you said, President Obama, Michelle Obama have had this longstanding debate about whether politics works, whether it's a force for good, whether you can believe in it, whether you can have hope in it. And of course, we know that the title of President Obama's or then Barack Obama's autobiography. But do you think that Michelle Obama truly believes in that kind of hope that she talks about so eloquently?
Well, so, you know, a rule I always go by reporting on her is that I can never speak for her or psychologize her. I feel so often my reporting has come up against, you know, the limits of having to respect everything you don't know as a reporter instead of saying what you do know. So if we had the Obamas here right now, if we had Michelle Obama on this phone line, and wouldn't that be fun? Yes. I think what I would ask her about would be about how being inside the system changed her perspective. Part of what's interesting about her life is that she's gone back and forth from, you know, the South Side of Chicago to being in these very elite settings, you know, a fancy law firm, Princeton University, et cetera. And the White House is not only the most elite of all, but it also enables you to kind of see the way power works and be inside the system in a way that's utterly unique. And how great would it be if she could be with here, if she could be with us here today, and ask her, you know, what surprised her, what, you know, how her views changed, what she saw from a completely different perspective once she was inside. There's an experience like that she had in her life, which is her dad was a city water worker. And then later in life, she went on to work for the mayor's office of Chicago. So she saw the system she had grown up with from a totally different point of view. And it would be great to hear her describe the White House version of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to add to that, Veronica?
I think that there's no way that she can't have hope. I think that the way that she's raised those girls and the way that she's opened up the White House to so many children and the way that she's been, as Jody mentioned, a really powerful figure around the world. I mean, when she spoke to girls from Africa, she said, you know, the situation may not be comfortable. You may not always feel powerful, but if you keep going forward, there will be opportunities. A window will open, a door will crack, and you will find your way. You will find the next step. And I think that one of the things she she epitomizes is the art of life as an improvisation. I think she's been, in many ways, making it up as she goes along, saying, how far can I push it? What can I do today? What can I make possible? And I think that that's very powerful for all of us and what we're going to have to do going forward. We're going to have to make it up as we go along and be as powerful as we can be in every moment.
Let me get Bill from Philadelphia in on our conversation. And Bill, you've been very patient. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I really see the role that Michelle Obama played as many of the things you said, as well as just giving not only African-American young females and young boys, you know, opportunity to see a family that has well-educated individuals and aspire to the highest level of, you know, the free world as far as being the president and the first lady. And also, it gave not only American Caucasians and, you know, every other race opportunity to see a positive, educated, classy family that just exuded, you know, what a president and first lady should be and can be and has been. Which, as far as I'm concerned, is going to be a really, really hard act to follow.
Bill, for all of us, I think. For all of us, Bill.
So that was basically what I wanted to say.
Well, I'm glad you did. No, thanks for hanging on. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times as well. Let me just add something to what Bill just said, and this is actually Gloria Steinem. There was a series of articles about Michelle Obama, and she said, "We will never have a democracy until we have democratic families and a society without the invented categories of both race and gender. Michelle Obama may have changed history in the most powerful way, by example." Joe, do you want to weigh in on what Bill said?
Well, that word classy came up in my reporting in such an interesting way once. When I was working on my book, I went to hear Michelle Obama give an address at West Point. It was a graduation ceremony, and it was quite a scene because West Point graduates, a lot of them go to war. A lot of them go into combat. So these parents were obviously very proud of their kids, but they were also there to applaud a graduation that was going to essentially launch their children into danger. All these families had come from all over the nation, most from very conservative backgrounds. It was a diverse crowd, but, you know, I would say military families tend towards the Republican side more. And Michelle Obama gave a beautiful speech. It was really, it was not only inspiring, but, you know, she talked about war and sending your kids to war and the terrible price that the nation pays for defending itself. It was deeply affecting. She sort of placed herself in a long line of first ladies back to Martha Washington. And after she spoke, I asked, you know, a whole bunch of people in the hall what they had thought. And one person said to me, they said, "You know, I hadn't been expecting much. I thought she would probably give some sort of political speech, but it was actually very classy." Hmm. And I was so struck by that word classy because I thought, really? You didn't expect her to be classy? Like, she's the First Lady of the United States. And I had covered her for so many years at that point that I'd always thought of Michelle Obama as classy. And so the idea that even, and this was well into the presidency, by the way, she wasn't a stranger to anybody in the audience, the idea that it would still come not as a given, that they would think of her as classy, I thought was so interesting.
Yeah, I'm giving you the last word, Veronica, about 30 seconds.
Okay, well, I think that what to me that anecdote says is that, you know, we're talking a lot right now about bubble bursting, is that I think as much as we've benefited from images held on high, you know, the real change happens when people get to know people. And we really are transformed by the ways in which we interact with each other one-on-one. And I think Michelle Obama has exemplified that. I think she's done her part to burst bubbles. I think, like the military families, there's been a lot of sacrifice. And I think she leaves us on a high note. I think that when they go low, we go high. I think we're leaving on a high note.
Veronica Chambers, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Editor of The Meaning of Michelle, 16 Writers on the Iconic First Lady. She's currently a JSK Fellow at Stanford University, and she and a number of the writers of her book will be at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight. Jody Kantor, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And she is a New York Times correspondent and author of The Obamas. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us.